All right, so we are holding for Pay on the Day, third line, the wide line. We started talking about the concept of a sando. We said a sando is a baby that got flattened out. There's two babies in the womb, basically, and one of them causes the other one to get flattened out. And it becomes a thing shaped like a certain kind of fish called a sando, which is, you know, there's a kind of flat fish called a sole, so it could bring people. There's actually a kind of flat fish called a sole, because it's called that because it's shaped like the sole of a shoe. So it could very well be that that's what the Gemara means here by a fish called sandal. The other thing, you know, Shimon Gamliel had said, compared it to the shape of the tongue of a large ox. Either way, the point is it's flattened out. Nevertheless, we're saying the sandal is considered a baby. So we discussed the question, does it actually have to have a recognizable face or not? And then Rabbi Sein said it did, but then in the end we said that Rabbi Yannai said it doesn't need to, even if it doesn't have a suras panim, it's still tummy later. But I'm actually giving the reason for it, because he said, yes, of course, in principle, it should have a panim. It started out of the baby. However, sometimes you can have that a lot of blood congeals on it, and therefore you don't find a recognizable face on it. But nevertheless, the Rambam says, since after all, as the Gemara is going to talk about now, after all, a sandal is always accompanied by a regular baby, so she's anyway tomei from the birth of the regular baby, then therefore the Chachamim declared her tomei for the birth of the sandal as well. Okay, so now let's work out this issue further. So I'm going to ask, Lomi Skid with sandal. Why do we have to mention that she's tomei if she gives birth, if she miscarries, whatever, a sandal? Whenever you have a sandal, you always have a baby with it. So no matter what, she's tomei for the other baby.
Always.
How does a sandal come about? We said because you have another baby that grows at the expense of this one and causes it to get flattened out. So why do we need to say that she's tomei later for the sandal, if anyway she's tomei later for the live baby? So the Gemara says, actually, if the live baby that was born together with the sandal was a girl, then you're right. Indeed, you don't have to worry about the sandal, because even if she had had regular twins, two live babies, one a boy and one a girl, as we said yesterday, the din would be she would only have the Yemei Tumah and the Yemei Tahara for a girl. We would ignore the boy for that purpose, because the Yemei Tumah of a boy are included within the Yemei Tumah of a girl. For a girl, for a boy, it's 7 days. For a girl, 14. So therefore, she's Tumah for 14 days, and then she's Tahara for 66, and that's that. We don't worry, but we don't, there's nothing to add, right? So therefore, what?
Tumah for the boy and for the girl.
No, you know, it's not one after the other. They run concurrently. So therefore, so yeah. So if the live baby born with a sandal is a girl, then you're right. There's no reason to worry about the sandal. Hach, my skin, this yalad zochavade. But when we talk about in the Mishnah, we say that if she miscarries a sandal, then we said she has to have the Yemei Tumah and Tahara to be on the safe side for a boy and for a girl. It's talking about where the live baby that was born was a boy. So therefore, now you have a suffix. What was the sandal? If the sandal was also a boy, then she just needs 7 and 33 days. If it was a girl, then she needs 14 and 66.
If we say the sandal was a baby.
Well, the sandal definitely was a baby at one point. That's what we're saying.
It would have been a baby without a face.
No, okay, but most babies develop faces. And in this one, again, we said that according to many opinions, we said it needs suras panim. We said Rabbi Yannai is machmir if it's not having a suras panim, but fine, as the Rambam says, that's only because there may be a lot of blood congealed on it which hides the suras panim. But essentially, it did start developing as a normal baby, or at least we assume it does. Most babies do. So in this case, so if a boy was born, so now you have a suffix. Was the sandal a boy or a girl? So now what happens is, Maudetema, now you would have thought, if the Mishnah hadn't told us, you would have thought like this. Rabbi Yitzchok Ba'ami. Rabbi Yitzchok Ba'ami says, towards the end of our parak, the famous expression, Isha Mazras Tchila Yeledesok, or if the woman gives seed first, then she gives birth to a boy, and we'll explain in a second what that means. Ish Mazriya Tchila Yeledes Nekeva, if the man gives seed first, then she gives birth to a female. So we're going to mention that.
They both need each other.
Obviously, right. But we're going to, right.
Wait,
so, one second. So there's two possibilities. There's two major possibilities what it means in biological terms. Either what it means is, so of course, you know, with the woman, there's ovulation, and that happens at, sometimes they have relations, and she ovulates only a couple of days later, especially, I mean, again, keep in mind, nowadays, that we have 12 days minimum between when the woman has her period and when she goes to the mikveh, it's much less likely for her to ovulate before she goes to the mikveh. odds are she's going to ovulate around the time she goes to the mikveh or a day or two before it.
Well, but she could
generally, because it's usually about 2 weeks. But in those days where you didn't need that much time, where you only needed seven days, right? So it was today it's always a minimum of 12. So therefore, it was very possible to have that she could ovulate long before, not long before, but whatever, sometime before she and her husband have. So that's one possibility of Ish Mazriat Chila versus Ish Mazriat Chila, is when the ovulation is relative to having relations. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that it refers to which one reaches orgasm first. And sometimes you have that the woman does first and sometimes the man first.
Well, what should it be relevant?
That could be relevant because that would affect
the man and
it's like sometimes, not always. Not always. It depends.
Yeah, but it
actually does because what you have is, because the environment over there is depending on the alkalinity of it or whatever, sometimes can be more hospitable to X bearing or Y bearing sperm, whatever there are. There are certain details about the environment over there, the vaginal environment. That's not the only factor, but whatever.
It's a major factor.
Okay, it's a major factor, but it's not the only one. So the Gemara talks about, towards the end of our Masechta, famous expression, that, which the Gemara actually brings Pesukim on it, that Ish Mazriat Tchila Yeledes Nekeva, if the man emits seed first, then she'll give birth to a girl. Ish Mazriat Tchila Yeledes Zachar, if the woman emits seed first, then she'll give birth to a male. However you explain it, whether you explain it either of these ways, whether you have other possible ways of explaining it, whatever it is, that's the Gemara takes that as a given. Beruchnius, by the way, Chiddush talks about in many places, the idea that it represents the Sirusa de la Ela versus the Sirusa de la Sata. When you have an Avodah that starts out with the Sirusa de la Sata, Isha Mazrat Chila, we who are like the female relative to Hashem, who is the male, the Mashpia, when we emit seed first, meaning when we take the initiative in our Avodah, Yeledes Zachar, then it makes a much more powerful type of Avodah and a much more powerful type of effect on the world than it does when Hashem takes the initiative. Anyway, getting back to the...
say that it's an X sperm or a Y sperm.
Understood, but the point, obviously, no. There's no question, obviously, you need an X sperm to produce a girl and you need a Y sperm to produce a boy. We know that. But I'm saying one possibility is the Gemara may be saying that depending, if ovulation took place of some time before they had relations, then it's more likely to be a boy. And the other possibility is that the Gemara means that if she reached orgasm first, then it's more likely to be a boy because then in those cases the Y bearing sperm are more likely to make it there first. Whatever, it is a known fact. There are factors that can affect which one tends to get there first. So, okay. Anyway, so given that fact that we're saying, so midaha zachar, so we would argue like this, since the one boy who was born alive was male, ha nami zachar, shouldn't we assume that the sandal that comes along with it very likely was a boy also? Now, obviously, you do have such a thing as you have twins that are boys and girls, but here where a sandal is an unusual enough thing as it is, it's more likely that they came from the same conception and therefore that they were born from one fertilized zygote that split. Well, for one thing, I guess, because if they were separate ones, then you'd have less likelihood that one is going to be growing at the expense of the other. Among other things, they'd be in two different amniotic sacs, so there's less likelihood that one is going to push against the other when they're identical twins. And if they're identical, they're almost always going to be the same sex. Then it's more likely, maybe, that the Gemara assumes it's more likely that one of them might press against the other one. So given that that's the case, Ema, so you would think that maybe then both of them were boys, and in that case there shouldn't be a suffix. We would say that she just has 7 days and 33 days. Kamash Malan. Therefore, the Mishnah tells us, after all, you have a suffix. Ema, he's real shenem b'vasachas. After all, it is possible that they were both Mazriya at the same time, and therefore you had twins, one boy and one girl, and the girl ended up getting flattened out into a sandal, and therefore you have the suffix. So that's the point. And therefore, Haizocha behind the Keva, and therefore one's a boy and one's a girl, and that is why the Mishnah tells us that you have the suffix. Because you could have that one of these two was a girl. Incidentally, Rashi mentioned
the halacha is
that if she gives birth to a male and also a sandal, then you have a suffix, and therefore, so you have to have 14 days, well, she's tummy either way because she had the boy, but the point is, she has 14 days of tumah in case the sandal was a girl, and only following that, 26 days of Yimei Tara, in case both of them were boys.
14 days
of Tumah in case it was a girl, and only 26 following days of Tara in case both of them were boys, and then your family has up to the end of 40 days before you make Tara. Incidentally, Rashi over here mentions the point also that one way you can have a sandal, Rashi mentions over here, and later on in the Masechta, this is going to be relevant also, that one way also a sandal can form is she was previously pregnant, and then she and her husband had relations again, and she conceived again. Rashi takes the view that even when a woman is pregnant, it could happen that she becomes pregnant again. It's a rare thing. In medical ease, it's called superfetation, but this sort of thing does exist. So that's another way in that case. The Gemara could have said very straightforwardly that you could have two of them because they're from two different conceptions. And one could be a boy, one could be a girl. Tosfos argues on that. Rabbeinu Tam learns that once a woman is pregnant, she can't become pregnant again. Tosfos learns on later on, we're going to learn in the fourth or fifth parak, we're going to talk about dinim of when a woman is allowed to use contraception, and one of them is if she's pregnant because you don't want the baby to become a sandal. So Rabbeinu Tam has to have his way of explaining how that would be possible if anyway once she's pregnant, she can't become pregnant again. But according to Tosfos or Gemara over here, it flows more straightforwardly because therefore the Gemara knows that the baby and the sandal can only possibly be from the same conception. And therefore, again, you would think that then in that case, it was probably only one egg fertilized by one sperm, which then split, and therefore it's two boys. But you're saying not necessarily. It could have, after all, been two separate ones, and one's a boy and one's a girl, and therefore... obviously by the same father, right, but still it could be fraternal rather than identical twins. I mean, for that matter, you know, even with identical twins, there can be chromosome splitting abnormalities where one of them ends up a boy and one of them ends up a girl, you know, where one of them has a Y and the other one is lacking it altogether, whatever. Okay, fine. Okay. So we're holding at the bottom of Kopeyam and Bay, second line from the bottom.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sure. So all of that is one reason why we have the suffix. If she miscarries a sandal, why do we, and there was a boy with it, then there's a suffix whether the sandal was a girl or not. But yes, if the live baby was a girl, there'd be no suffix. Gavra Acher, another reason why we have to mention the sandal. If the live baby is a girl, then there's nothing to talk about, even if it doesn't matter whether the sandal is a boy or a girl. Either way, she has the Yemei Tumah and Yemei Tahara for a girl. We ignore the sandal, even if it was a live boy, we ignore him for that.
Only
if the live one is a boy, then you have a problem. Dabra, so another explanation why we need to mention the sandal separately, and this one would apply even if the live baby was a girl. She impaled in the cable, if Neshkia Fahama, suppose that the woman gave birth to a girl before Shkia, with sandal or after Shkia Fahama, and then the sandal came out after Shkia, which of course is considered already the next day. So now you have to consider, when do we count the Yemei Tumah and the Yemei Tahara? Even if we assume that both of them are girls, nevertheless, she's going to have to count separately the possible days of when her nida cycle begins again, based on the first one and based on the second one. Namely, in other words, like this. Let's say, for example, so Rashi explained, but let's say, okay, so she had the first one before Shkia, then she had the second one after Shkia. Now let's fast forward 80 days. She has 14 Yemei Tumah and 66 Yemei Tahara for the first girl. Had there not been a second one, had there not been a sandal, then what happens is the 81st day conceivably could be the beginning of a new Nidah cycle. Namely, if she were to bleed on the 81st day, then she would be a Nidah. But now that we have the sandal involved, and now the sandal already was born after Shkia, so now if the sandal was a girl, and here after all you have the possibility, it could have been a girl, it could have been a boy. So now if she has bleeding on the 81st day from the first birth, it's only the 80th day from the second birth. So now we have a suffix. If the sandal was a girl, then okay, this is the 80th day, and it's still Yemei Tahara. If it's a boy, then it's already the 40 days for the boy of long since passed, and then she's a nigger. So now she'd have a suffix whether she's a nigger or not. Similarly, Rashi also,
if the sandal was a girl,
so even if the live baby was a girl and the sandal was a girl, you still have a suffix if one was born before Shkia and the other after Shkia. What happens if she bleeds on the 81st day? Is she a nidder or not? Or is it the last day of her dam toihar for the second one? So that's first of all, Rashi explained. That's first of all. Rashi also adds, these are the facts. The fact is, it would be a suffix. She'd be a suffix whether she's a nidder or not. She'd have to consider herself a nidder misuffix, but it also means that her counting is messed up until, as we've learned in Eichen, she has to have a certain number of clean days. She has to have at least 17 clean days, and then she's back on track. Anyway, Rashi points out another detail also. Let's say that also, let's say she bled on the 81st. Let's say also she bled on the 88th day. So now, if the 81st day was the beginning of her Nida cycle, then the 88th day, being the day after the 7 days, is the beginning of her Ziva cycle. Then it means she's a Zavakshana. On the other hand, if the 81st day is really the 80th day from the second baby, again, if the second baby, if the Sandal was a girl, then the first one was not Yumei Nida yet, because it's the last day of her Yumei Toihar, for the second baby. And then the 88th day is not really the 88th day after all. It's seven days after her Yumei Toihar ended, and only then does her Nida cycle start.
If the 81st day was with a sandal who was the girl.
One second. Let's forget about a sandal. Second. Let's talk a plain case where she had two girls. Let's talk a plain case where she had two girls, and then we'll understand it more clearly how it works as far as a sandal.
Okay.
Suppose she has two girls. She has one before Shkia, one after Shkia.
What does that mean?
It means exactly like that. She had twins, and one came out before Shkia, and one came out a couple hours later after Shkia.
Okay. Yeah.
So now, let's consider. So let's say, for example, let's say this happened on Rosh Hashanah. So let's say the first day of Rosh Hashanah, it's always convenient to use that, you know. So let's say the first day of Rosh Hashanah, she had a girl before Shkia, and later that night after Shkia, going into the second night of Rosh Hashanah, she had another girl. So let's consider. Relative to the first girl, what would happen is we have 80 days total. During those 80 days, she can't be a Nida because 14 of them she's Tomei anyway from the birth, and the next 66 is Yumei Toihar. So what do we have? 30 days of Tishrei, 30 days of Cheshvan, and 20 days of Kislev. So up to and including the 20th day of Kislev, she bleeds, nothing happens, she's not a Nida. She's during the first 14 days, she's Tomei regardless whether she bleeds. And during the next 66 days, it's Dam Toihar. Even if she bleeds during that time, she's Mutar to her husband. That's how Dam Toihar works. Right. Now, because she had the second baby after Shkia, and that one is also a girl, so everything gets moved up one more day. So therefore, if she bleeds on the 21st of Kislev, it's still within the 80 days of that one. And again, therefore, it's still Dam Toihar. She's not a Nida. But let's say, for example, that let's say we had a suffix about, now let's talk about, suppose that back in the case of the sandal, the second baby, it's a suffix, whether it was a boy or a girl. So now we have an issue. Now if she bleeds on the 21st of Kislev, which is the 81st day since the first baby, what is it? Is that the 80th day from the second baby, which was a girl, and then she's not nigger yet? Or is it the second baby was a boy, the second baby, the sandal, may have been a boy, and then you only have 40 days, then who you may tell her expire in the middle of Cheshvan after 40 days, and then by now, if she bleeds on the 21st of Kislev, then she's a Nida. And if she bleeds the next week on the 28th of Kislev, then it's the beginning of her days of Ziva. Or not. So that's what we mean. In other words, that it's important to know, so even if the live baby that was born first was a girl, it's still critical to know, we still have a critical suffix that depends on whether the sandal is a boy or a girl. Well, again, that means that it's a suffix. So therefore, so if she ends up in this scenario, she ends up bleeding on the 21st and on the 21st of Kislev, and let's say also on the 28th of Kislev, the 81st day and the 88th day, respectively, then you have a suffix. Is she a Nida? Is she a Nida the first time, and is she a Zava the second time, or is she nothing the first time and a Nida the second time? And again, she's going to need a certain number of clean days in order to clear things up. Rashi points out there's another detail also, that you have the question, how long do her 14 days of Tumah last? Same idea. In other words, she has 14 days of Tumah after the birth of a girl. So for the first one that was born before Shkia and Rosh Hashanah, those run from Aleph through Yerdalad Tishrei. Now, for the second one, if it was a girl, then it runs from Beis through Tesvav Tishrei. And if not, if it's a boy, then it ends, then you only have the Yemei Tumah for the girl, then for the live girl, then ended Yerdalad. So that's the point. In other words, that's why we have this topic. That's why we say Keshav L'Zach over the Mekeva, which is relevant even if the live baby was a girl, because we don't know what the sandal was. And if one of them was born before Shkia and after, and the other one after Shkia, then you're still going to have a topic. Okay. So those are two possible reasons what we mean in our Mishnah when we have to talk about if she gives birth to a sandal, what happens. One is if she has a boy with it, and the other is even if she has a girl with it, but one was before Shkia and one was after. Then we have these various considerations. Okay. Next, the Gemara asks, Now, in Masechta Bechoros, we learned about a case where a woman miscarries a sandal. We said Habba Achra, the next baby that's born after that, is a Bechor as far as getting the double portion, but not as far as Pidyon HaBen. So Lamai Hilchta, what's the relevant? What's the relevance in Halacha of that? Now, the question again is that the Gemara, we know that Ein Sandal B'loi Wad, when there's a sandal, there's always a live baby with it. So therefore, the question is like this. If, so now, let's say, for example, if in Tavshin Ayin Tes, let's say, she had twins, one was a normal baby and one was a sandal and one was a normal baby, and then next year, Tavshin Pei, she has another baby, obviously that new baby born in Tavshin Pei is not a Bechor at all, there's nothing even to talk about. So again, we have to ask the question, what's the relevance of saying that Habba Achra, the one that comes after the sandal, is a Bechor Lamachla and not the Koyin? You anyway had one baby coming out. You had a baby coming out together with the sandal. The answer is, that's just it. Labar Achrav, Bechor L'Machrav, and Bechor L'Koyim. What we mean, yes, it is relevant when we say Labar Achrav means not for a baby who's born the following year from another pregnancy. We mean, suppose that the sandal is born first, and then the live baby comes out after that, and the Gemara is going to talk about soon that could happen.
So the first delivery
was the sandal, and then the live baby came out. In other words, the Gemara assumed, the Makshin assumed, that the live baby always comes out first. Because otherwise, no chiddush in it, right? Because the next baby is born the following year, obviously, it's not a bechor l'machla or l'koyim. So what we mean is, in other words, suppose the sandal happens. It's considered peter lechem. It's not a bechor l'machla because, as we learned the other day, ein libay dava olav. The father doesn't feel bad for such a baby because it wasn't anything viable in the first place. So therefore, it's not considered reishis oinai. It's not considered the first one that he would mourn for. Therefore, it's not, but it's still considered a Bechor as far as the general opinion, I bet. So if you had, she was pregnant with twins, and one of them ended up being a sandal, if the sandal ends up coming out first, and then the other baby is a boy, it won't be a Bechor as far as Pidyon HaBen, but it will be a Bechor as far as getting the double portion. That's the point. Okay.
Well, it's lucky for the
father
because he won't have to give
anything for the sandal. Of course, he doesn't have to give anything for the sandal because the only opinion I've been on the 30th day, and the sandal hasn't lived for 30 days. It was born stillborn. But the point is, the other baby is not a Bechor as far as opinion I've been because Kod Mayachar, it's not Peter Rechem, there was another baby before it. However, he is a Bechor as far as the double portion of the father's inheritance because he's the first viable baby.
Interesting that this. You consider Bechor for one thing and not...
Yeah, that's what we know. We learned that in Christmas. We talked about that. You have a person can be a Bechor L'Nachla and not L'Koyim, or vice versa. Yeah, but because they depend on two different factors. One depends on Peter Rechem and one depends on Reish HaSoinah. They're two different things. I mean, you have much simpler cases. If a man is married to two women, then when it comes to that's the thing. There's another difference. When it comes to Pidyon HaBen, it goes by the woman, Peter Rechem. They have to be the first one that opens the womb. So therefore, it has to be the woman's firstborn. But as far as Bechor L'Machla, it depends on it being the father's first. So a man who's previously been married, let's say, marries a woman who's never been married before, they have a baby. That baby's not going to be a Bechor L'Machla because he already has children from his first marriage, but it's going to be a Bechor L'Koyim from her first. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Yeah, to be figured out there.
Right. Okay. What about the Gemara Sandal B'Tinan Gabi Christus for my Yosha? What about now in the Masechta of Christus? We talked about a case where a woman miscarries a sandal, and we said she has to bring a korban for the birth. So again, what's the relevance of that? If a sandal was always accompanied by a baby, then she anyway has to bring a korban for the live baby. The answer is Shem Taled Blad Derech Doifin, the sandal Derech Rechem. Suppose that she had the normal baby, the live baby came out by C-section, and the sandal came out through the womb. But nevertheless, hypothetically, it could happen. And hypothetically, maybe, but I mean, I don't know, there's a sandal in there, whatever. The point is that the sandal ends up coming up through the womb. We would say, so she doesn't bring a korban for the one born by C-section, because you only bring a korban for a baby born by normally, vaginally, but the mice a korban, a sandal, but she will have to bring a korban for the sandal because that did come out normally. So that's the relevance of mentioning sandal in that case. So the question is, what of Shimon? What about according to Reb Shimon's opinion? The Omar, where he says in the next parak, Yotze Derech Dolfin Vlad Mal Yehu, he says that a baby born by C-section is 100% considered like a regular birth, and she does. Malia means full-fledged. In other words, therefore, that's for all purposes. So the mother is Tomei for the birth. It is considered Peter Rechem, etc. Yeah. So according to him, No, well, not like him, right? So according to him, Ma'ikalamim, or according to him, why is it relevant in Masechta Krisus to mention the case where a woman miscarried a sandal, even if, as we just said, the normal baby, the live baby was born by C-section, and the sandal was born by was born derech rechem. Reb Shimon would say she has to bring a korban for the live baby anyway. So who cares that she had a sandal? The answer is Amar Reb Yirmiya, Shem Teled Vlad B'Yosa, is that a Sechavim? Suppose you have a woman who gave birth to twins, vaginally, the regular way, but the live one was born while she was still a goita, the sandal la'achashinis gaira, and then afterwards, then she went to the mikveh, and then afterwards,
okay, she
converted during her pregnancy.
So she
gave birth to one, and then the son, she was a goiter before, she gave birth to one baby while she was still a goiter, then before the sandal came out, before the delivery was finished, she went to the mikveh, and now afterwards the sandal came out.
Why not?
I mean, she could dip in water. She could conceivably dip in water. But wait, actually, we're gonna mention something else soon. But wait. Okay. The demaisa, korban, a sandal, in that case, it's relevant because then in that case, for the first baby, she's not bringing a korban because she wasn't Jewish yet when she had it, but for the second one, for the sandal. But that's the reason why we have to mention the case where she miscarried a sandal, because there could be a case where she has to bring a korban for the sandal without having to bring a korban for the live baby that comes. On the face of it, not the way. Let's see.
Let's change the clock.
No. Okay. Amruah Rabbanan Kameh D'Rapapa. So the Chachamim in the yeshiva set over these statements and these answers to the Papa, and they asked, "Umi isnu lahani shinri? Are any of these answers valid? All of these answers assume that the sandal and the live baby come out separately. But v'hotanya, we learn in a brayta, ken yosin, when a baby comes out together with a sandal, ein yosin ela kruchin, they come out wrapped one around the other.
The sandal is wrapped around
the other baby, yeah, or the baby is wrapped around the sandal, is the case maybe. So that's it. So then in that case, so how do you have any case where one is going to be one way and the other way, right? Amar Apophis, that Apophis says, Shmamina, in that case, we can deduce from that, since after all, we have these Mishnayos that mention in Christus and in Bechorus that imply that the sandal and the regular baby can be born separately. And the fact is, we see that when a sandal is born, it's wrapped around the regular baby, then that means Michrach Korich Levlad LaSandal Apalge. It means they are wrapped together. However, they're not parallel to each other from head to toe. Rather, what it is Michrach Korich Levlad LaSandal, the live baby, will be wrapped around the sandal, a palge, around the midsection of it, and it will be offset towards its head. So in other words, Rashi explains what it means is, in other words, that you'll have that the Vlad will sort of be, the sandal, the flattened baby, will be like sort of on top of, at the head end of the live baby. So the live baby's head will be touching what would have been the navel of the other baby, and now it's flat. So what is that? So the
line against each other.
So in other words, what you have is, so here's the live baby, here's its head, and it's not lying parallel to the sandal over here. Rather, its head is by the sandal's midsection. They're offset. Mishalchis means offset, klapi ratio towards its head. So therefore, what does that mean? Gabe Bechorus. So in the case in Bechorus, where we talked about that the woman gave birth to a sandal and then to a regular baby, and we're saying the regular baby is not considered a Bechorus as far as Pinyin Aben, so what's the scenario if when she yotzu derech rasheihem? The case would have to be, therefore, that both of them are coming out head first, the sandal kodim menofik. So what happens is, because the sandal's head is ahead of the live baby's head, therefore it comes out first. And once it comes out first, then it's considered born. So therefore, at that point, it's peter rechem, and therefore the other one is not.
But it's not bachal.
What?
It's not bachal.
The sandal is dead anyway. So there's nothing to talk about. It's not a bachal l'machla or l'koyin. The point is that the next baby, the one that comes out immediately after it, when its head starts coming out, he's not a bachur as far as Chidyon Aben, but he is a bachur as far as Nachla, because the previous one is not Mishal Libay Dover Olam. The new baby is the first one that the father would feel bad and then mourn for his death if he was to die. Okay. Gabi Christus. And in the case in Christus, we were talking about, we're saying that the woman has to bring a korban for the sandal, and we said the scenario is that she was becoming a ziyoris between one and the other, and you asking, Rav Papa is saying to his Talmidim, you're asking how could that be if one is wrapped around the other. But again, he says you have to keep in mind that we're saying that they're not completely wrapped around each other, they're offset.
They're wrapped around, but one is at the
midsection of the other.
Right.
So therefore, shiyotu jerach magulasehem. So the scenario could be that the normal baby and the sandal are being born feet first. It's a breech birth. Devlad kodim menafik. In that case, then the live baby ends up coming out first. But then you could have the scenario that it was coming out, that most of its body came out, which at that point is considered born mahalacha, before the mother converted, and then she went to the mikveh, and then the sandal started coming out, and now she has to bring a korban for the sandal. Achronim talk about, by the way, on the face of it, in that case, wouldn't you have that the Nela before we assume that she toveled between the births? Then fine, that's possible. There's no problem with chatzitza. But here, where you have it, it's already coming out. Don't you have an issue with chatzitza? All of her body has all of the surfaces of her body have to be able to be touched by the water. And over here, you have part of her. Over here, you have her birth canal, her vaginal area is partially being blocked by this baby or by this sandal that's half out. So they're trying to give a number of different answers on it. One is that midaraisa would still be considered a valid tefillah, because midaraisa is only considered a chatzitza if either she minds it being there or it covers most of the body. Only midrabanan do we have other rules for chatzitza. Fine, here we're talking about on midaraisa level, was it a valid tefillah? Okay. All right. We're not necessarily talking about that rabbanim told her to go then, but she herself decided to toggle at that point. Right. Okay. The rabbanim have to be there. Fine, but she decided right now. You know what? Right now, I want to do it. I don't want to wait another minute. Okay, fine. So all of that is one answer. Rav Huna bar Tachlifa gives a different answer in the name of Rava. You don't have to say necessarily like you, the Papa, are saying that the two, that the normal baby and the sandal are offset, one relative to the other. You could say, I feel the same with Tzimtzumin. You could actually say that we're talking about that sometimes the normal baby and the sandal might be born, or generally, they're both born side by side. They both come out together. But Epoch Shmeitza. But we can flip around this that Rav Papa had said, that the case in Bechoris involves where they came out head first, and the case in Christus involves where it came out feet first. You can flip that around. In the case of Bechoris, Shiyotu Jerach Magalasehem, we would say the case is that both babies, the normal one and the sandal, are being born feet first. It's a breech birth. So what happens? Vlad, the Isbe Chayusa. So what happens is the normal baby, because it's alive, so therefore, like it holds on, it doesn't get out that quickly. It resists being born basically. So it doesn't come out that easily. Sandal, the less bechayuta, as opposed to the sandal, is a piece of dead flesh after all, because the flattened out baby. Therefore, shortest benefic, so it just slides and comes right out. So therefore, the sandal may end up, so even though they started out parallel to each other, the sandal winds up coming out first. And therefore, the next baby, by the time most of its body is out, which is what you need if it's coming out feet first, you need most of the body to be out for it to be considered born. By that time, the sandal's already out. It's easier for the sandal to get out. Gabi Christus, in the case of Christus, where we're saying the case is that the woman became a geyoris in the middle, we could say Shiyotu Jerach Rashehen, the opposite of what Rav Papa said. We're talking about they were normal births, head first, as a baby normally comes out. No, there is a sandal, obviously. In Christus, we mentioned the case where a woman has to bring a korban for having given birth to a sandal. But we were asking what's the relevance of having to be giving a korban for the sandal. Anyway, you have a live baby with it.
Right.
So now Rav Huna bar Tachlifa is explaining that we could be talking about that both the normal baby and the sandal are coming out head first, but Vlad the Ispe Chayusa, the normal baby, because it's alive, so therefore the din is midin nafik reshe, as soon as the head of it comes out, have you later, it's already considered a birth. When the baby comes out feet first or any other position, then most of the body has to come out. But if it's born head first, once the head comes out, then already it's considered born. As opposed to sandal ad nafik rube, as opposed to the sandal being that it's not alive, it's only considered born when most of it comes out.
and therefore, in that case, then the sandal comes with the sandal coming out. Most of it coming out takes place after the normal baby is born first, and therefore, that's what we're saying, that if after the normal one started to be born, then the mother dipped in the mikveh, and only then did the sandal finish coming out. Then she's bringing a carbon for the sandal only because the first baby was born while she was still a goat.
If you have the normal baby coming out as a breech,
then it's only considered born lahalacha once most of it comes out.
How much is most of
it? Most of the body. Most of the body. 51% of the body. Yeah.
Where is 51%?
I don't know. I guess it depends on the shape. I guess it depends on the exact shape of the baby. I don't know. I guess it would be. About the navel. I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Could be. Right. Fine. Okay. Mishnah says, Shulya Babayis, if you find a Shulya in a house, Habayis Tomei, then the house is Tomei. Now, a Shulya, the last couple of days when we talked about Shulya a few days ago, I translated it as placenta. That's not really the accurate translation. The Shulya is more the amniotic sac. It's the complete sac. Yeah, I checked. It's the complete sac where one end of it basically is the placenta, but it's the complete sac that the baby forms inside. In modern Hebrew, by the way, they use the word shir, which we talked about the other day in the Gemara. We talked about the shir. They use that to mean the amniotic sac, which I guess is highly confusing for Israelis who learn these Gemaras. But then in Gemara terminology, the shir means the actual skin, the actual membranes of the baby itself, that is bones and muscles and whatever are developing inside, as opposed to the shirya, the amniotic sac, with the placenta being at one end of it.
With the placenta.
The placenta is part of the amniotic sac, basically.
No,
well, okay, I mean, it's all attached, whatever. So, shulya babayis, habayis tomei, lo shal shulya vlad. Now, it's not that the shulya per se is a baby, so there's no reason that it itself should be matami the house.
The hospital is always
coming. Well, yeah, I mean, well, so one second. In shulya bloy vlad, what it is whenever there's a shulya, there's a baby. So therefore, if the woman miscarried a shulya, and they didn't find a baby, then we say the house is Tomei anyway. There's no baby. What's there to be the time of the house? There must have been a baby there because in Shulya Bloy Vlad, so there had to have been a baby, and therefore it's the time. I mean, hospitals in general are Tomei mess anyway because you have dead bodies and you have morgues and whatever. No, in the normal case, we have a live birth, then the Shulya is not Matame because the baby itself is alive. It's not Matame.
No,
we're talking about here. We're talking about where she miscarried only a Shulya and we don't find a baby. So we have to assume there was a baby, and we just don't get
then
it's also Matame, sure. Reb Shimon Omer Nimek Avlad at Shelo Yetzer. Reb Shimon says, what happened was the baby got dissolved and became blood, and now it's mixed in with the blood from the birth. Because Nimoya, I don't know, but I don't know, that's a good question. Nimek Avlad, the baby dissolved at Shelo Yetzer before it was born, and therefore it's bottle beroy, it's bottle in the blood of the birth, and therefore Reb Shimon would say it's not Matame. Let's talk about a shulya. What is the definition of a shulya for this purpose where we say there had to have been a baby? Shulya, tchilosa doma lachot shel erev, the one end of it resembles the thread of an erev, the warp thread that we said the other day. When they weave, you have the shefi threads and you have the erev threads that pass back and forth. The erev thread is a little bit thicker. So one end of the shulya resembles that. That would be, I guess, the umbilical cord end. The sofa jomek a turmus, the other end of it is wider, like a turmus, which is a type of bean. The halula kachatit teres, the whole thing is hollow, like a trumpet. The en shulya kachutim tefach, and a shulya is never less than a tefach in length. In other words, the point is, therefore, what the Gemara is telling us is if it doesn't meet these criteria, for example, if it's shorter than a tefach, then we don't say the rule of on Mishnah that it's matame the house. That's true, but the minimum size that's the possible. Right. In other words, that's the point. If the amniotic sac is smaller than that, it means the baby has not yet reached the stage of development that would be matame to have. So that's the definition.
Meaning
from one end to the other. From side to side, I guess. With that said, by the way, there are Rishonim who say that nowadays we should be machmer and be matame, and then be matame the woman from the birth and be matame the house. Anyway, which is relevant as far as Tainim, because we can't always be sure. It's not always easy to measure and to know which measurement we're doing. Okay. Rav Shimon Gamliel, defines it all differently. Shulya doma lekukuban shel tarnagolim shehadakin yotzin mimena. the shulia, this amniotic sac, resembled the stomach, the korkovan, means the gizzard of a chicken. Yeah, they ran in Holland. The gizzard of a chicken, shadakin yotinimena, with the intestines stick out of it. So the same way, in other words, the shulia is this roundish thing, is this roundish or ovalish. It's bigger, but he's comparing it in shape. In other words, in shape, it's similar to a korkovan that has the kishkis sticking out of it. So the same way over here, like you have it, the roundish thing with the umbilical cord or whatever sticking out of it. Tanya, Rav Oshi is the era de min chavraya. Rav Oshi is the era de min chavraya, Torah Braita. This phrase, by the way, is the era de min chavraya. On the side of here, it brings that Rashi and Tosfos and a few other places have different explanations. Does it mean Rav Oshi the era? Does it mean Oshi the small, because he's short, maybe, de min chavraya, from among the chaverim in the yeshiva, or maybe chavraya is the name of a place? Or another possibility, Oshi the era de min chavraya. The min chavraya means from. It could be that it means from among the chavraya, from among the tamar chachamim.
Say the chavraya.
Maybe, but not necessarily. Sometimes it can use the min from a place. But another possibility is it means Oshia was his actual name. The ira the min chavraya, the smallest or the least of the chaverim of the tamar chachamim.
In
Torah or in whatever, I don't know, maybe in height or who knows. Anyway, whatever. So anyway, he said chamisha shiuran kemach. He taught a braisa that there are five things in halacha where the minimum size of them is a kemach. The Elohein, shulya, shofar, shedra, doifan, sukkah, va'ezoid. So let's go through them. Shulya ha'damoran, the shulya we just said. We said the minimum length for it to be considered a shulya is one kefach. If it's shorter than that, then the house is not tame as a result of it. Shofar, what do we mean? Shofar, detanya, yeah, we learn in the Sefer Roshan. Kama yehei shir shofar, what's the minimum length of a shofar? Kira shim shimming amdil, kadeshi yechazenu biyodei, v'yero lakanu lakan, kefach. It has to be big enough that you can hold it in your hand and it'll be visible from both sides, namely a kefach. In other words, the point is, you're holding the shofar in your hand. It has to be at least a tefach long, otherwise, before she said, otherwise it looks like you're blowing into your hand. It's not obvious that you have a shofar. So therefore, in other words, the shofar has to be long enough that when that's the point. So it has to be slightly long. It has to be, no, because your hand is not a full tefach in length. The tefach is the width of four thumbs. Your other fingers are not as wide as a thumb.
Four thumbs?
Four thumbs is a tefach. So your other fingers are narrower than your thumbs. Therefore, if you hold the shofar with your four fingers, then it's slightly less than a tefach, and therefore you have enough room for it to stick out on the end and for it to be obvious that it's a shofar. With that said, there are rishonim, I think, to say for yireim, actually, it's not much, but it's slightly. Okay. You're looking at the length of it. I'm talking about the width.
No, I'm comparing the finger to the.
Okay, but different fingers are different widths. Your little yeah, the same. I don't know. I'm gonna do your little finger is much narrower.
It has to be. The little finger, but I'm talking about the index.
You're holding it with your four fingers. You're not holding it with four index fingers. You don't have four index fingers on your hand. You have an index finger, you have a middle finger.
Yeah.
So
with your
that's the point. Then you have slightly less than a tefach.
Because
the tefach is four tefach. Exactly. So therefore, once the shofar is at least one tefach long, then you have room for it to stick out. With that said, there are rishonim, I think, to say for yireim, learns that what the Gemara means is it has to stick out a tefach beyond your hand. That's not the accepted halacha. The halacha is, like we're saying over here, it has to be at least a tefach long. Okay. Practically speaking, a shofar that short would be very, very hard to blow, but that is the minimum.
I wonder.
Well, if it's less than a tefach, it's possible. Okay. So there's the second thing that's a tefach. Shedram.
What happens if someone's got a small hand?
Okay, so then the point is it still needs to be a tefach. Adrab, if he has a bigger hand, then it needs to be a larger amount. The point is it always needs to stick out. The person who's holding the shofar.
We go by him.
So if he has a smaller hand, you still need a tefach. The minimum is a tefach. If he has a larger hand, then you need it to be larger than a tefach because you need it to stick out beyond his hand.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. Shedra mahi, what do we mean as far as a shedra that has to be minimum tefach? The amr of parnach amr of yeshan, and shedra is a lulav, we mean the shedra of the lulav, I'm sukkis, sarach shihe yotim in a hadas tefach. It has to stick out in height at least one tefach beyond the hadasim. Meaning, in other words, so you have the hadasim are bound to the lulav, you have to have the shedra of the lulav has to stick out at least one tefach above that. Okay, I love it, usually much more, but... Doifen sukkah, what do we mean a wall of a sukkah? The Tanya, famous braisa that says shayim kol chosam, the minimum number of walls for a sukkah, you have to have two full walls, shlishis, a tefach, and the third wall can be only one tefach in width. Actually, the Gemara says there, the, what you do is it has to be a drop, or a drop wider than one tefach, and then you put it within three tefachim of one of the other walls, and that's lavud, and therefore you have most of the
lavud has to be
in width. So therefore, if you have it within three tefachim of one of the other,
the tree bends.
That's something else. That's because when you make walls out of canvas or whatever, some people say that you're not yotze because they flap in the wind. That's another matter. We're not saying that there you're also using lavud, but that's a different matter. You were talking about as far as the walls of the sukkah. So you have two. You have one piece. That's one tefach.
Two full, one piece
of the tefach. You put it within three tefachim of one of the other walls, and that way you have the minimum. That way you have four tefachim in length, which is most of a wall, and therefore yeah. Okay. Azoi. What do we mean? Azoi has to be at least a tefach. Okay, but in principle, it's allowed. Ezoiv, what do we mean? Ezoiv has to be at least a tefach. The tonnet up here, Ezoiv tefach. The Ezoiv has to be at least one tefach. Now, what we mean, the Ezoiv is, there's a few different places in Halakha where you need an Ezoiv. You need Ezoiv for the first stage of the purification of a Masorda. That's described at the beginning of the Parashat Masorda. It's an herb. The Ezoiv is an herb. It's something like oregano, marjoram, or something like that, whatever, but it's used in a few different places.
If it
has a stem and it has leaves on it, yeah. So in the Mitzrayim, they used it, they dipped it in the blood of the Kohen Pesach and applied it to the doors, but Lodotus, what you have is, in future generations, you have when a Masorda Saras is healed, the first stage is that the Kohen takes a piece of cedar wood and a piece of Ezoiv and a red string, whatever, and checks and bird and then dips the other things into the water and blood mixed together. So you need an Ezoiv that's at least a tefach long. Also for the paradroma, when they're burning the paradroma, they have to throw in a piece of Ezoiv that's at least a tefach long. And some of the Mephoshim say also the Ezoiv that has to be used for sprinkling the paradroma water is what the Gemara, some say that that's what the Gemara means here also. Okay. Fine. So those are the five things that need to be at least a tefach. So Chanina Bar Papa says you should know that Shila from Kfar Tamarta taught a Braisa also regarding these five things, saying Klas Nasnisa Vatauti Shmaitza. Of these five things that we just listed, you should know three of them are in Braisis and two of them are statements of Amaroyim. So the question is Shiura Tefach, but all of them have a Shiura Tefach. So the Gemara says, what do you mean? Tauti, what do you mean two of them are statements of Amaroyim? Chabit, you only have one, because we have the first one, the one about the Shulia was a Braisa, Tonon Abanon. The one about the Shofar was also a Braisa, Peter Shimshim Yamil, the Tanya Tamiya Heshir Shofar. The third one about the Shedra, that was a statement of Amaroyim, that's your Parnach in the name of Rabbi Yechanan. The fourth one, Dofen Sukkah, was also a Braisa, the Tanya. And the fifth one, about the Ezer, is also a Braisa, the Toni Rabchia. So you only have one that's a statement of Amaroyim. What do you mean there are two? Amar Abaya, Ema, you have to change the wording of the last one, not Toni Rabchia, but Amar Rabchia, Ezer Tefa. Toni Rabchia means that he taught it as a Braisa, that he learned from his Rebbeim and taught it as a Braisa. Amar Rabchia means he said it as an independent statement. And Rav Chiya, being in the transitional generation between the Tanoim and Amoraim, he's usually considered an Amora. And therefore,
he's usually very reliable.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the point is, if he says a statement, not as a Braisa, then it's a statement of Amoraim. So that's what we're saying. Of these five things that we said, that are Tefach, two of them are statements of Amoraim. The one about the Shedra of the Lulav, and the one about the Aegis.
So the rest is
from Braisa. He said the other three are from Braisa. So the Gemara says, the two lekka. Are you telling me there are no other things other than these five where you have a shear of something that has to be a tefach? The ha'ika, you have another one. Tefach al tefach al rum tefach meruba. When you have an area of at least one tefach cubed, one tefach in length, one in width, one in height, maybe it's a tumah. Such a thing is able to bring tumah, but a small, oh, that's the minimum size for an oil. So that's the minimum size to transmit tumah from one thing to another in the same oil. Meaning, so if you have a tiny oil like that, and at one end inside that oil you have a kezias or a mess, and at the other end of it you have a keli or something, that keli will become tumah. The chotzitz b'fnei tumah, and also that also an oil tefach al tefach blocks the tumah, meaning that if you have the kezias from the mess inside this oil, and you have something else sitting on top of the oil, it will remain tumah because the oil blocks it. You see, there's another thing that's a tefach. The answer is the Gemara says tefach. I mean, we're only talking about where you have a tefach in one dimension. Tefach, I'll tefach lo tamin. We're not talking about where you have square or cubic tefach. So yeah, of course, there is a din of a tefach there, but that's not the kind of thing that we're trying to list over here. Okay, What about, what about though we have a din like this? We learned in Chulin, we had an extensive discussion in Chulin, in Perikah Orva Roitev, about the concept of Yad L'Truma, where we said that you can have an object that is capable of becoming Tomei, or an object that's capable of transmitting Truma to something else, that when you have a Yad, when you have a handle attached to it, so that handle can also be, the Truma can go in and out through that as well. So now one example is that you can have an oven, which ovens in those days typically were made out of baked earthenware. They were made out of clay.
Like conical.
They were more or less conical, right? And they were made out of clay, and then they were made out of clay and fired, so they were earthenware. And the Torah tells us that an oven can become tamei. So now, suppose you have, a Mishnah in Kalim says, Evan hayotim in a tanur kefach. So if you have a stone that is attached to the tanur and sticks out, attached to the oven, and sticks out up to one, and sticks out a tefach, uminakira sholosh its voice, or if it's attached to a kira, which is a slightly smaller oven, Rashi defines that a tanur is where you can put two pots on it, and a kira is where you can put one pot. Tosfos actually points out on the days that usually the Gemara elsewhere says that a kira actually could hold two pots. So then whatever it is, the point is a kira is slightly smaller than an oven. So when a kira, if it's up to three etzvos, chibur, then it's considered attached, then it's considered a yad. It's considered a yad. In the sense, for example, that Rashi says, let's say, for example, the oven became tomei, let's say, for example, a dead sheret fell into the oven, and let's say, for example, you had a loaf of bread sitting on top of this handle, on top of the stone that's attached to the oven. If the stone is up to a tefach long, then the bread will become tomei through yam. If the stone is longer than that, it won't, because longer than that, you don't need such a long handle for an oven, and therefore you're going to end up cutting it off, and therefore it's not considered a yam. We learned similar concepts when we talk about yodos, when we talked about ha'orva ha'rotev. We said there, for example, that let's say you have a stem of a fruit that's longer than you need. You only need a certain length of the stem to be able to handle the fruit, or a certain length of bone to handle a piece of meat, or whatever, then the extra is not considered a yad. So the same thing over here. If you have the stone is attached, and it's up to a tefach in length, then it's a yad, more than that not. So there you also have a tefach. The answer is, so it's considered attached. The answer is, fine, but our list of five things that are a tefach, heichad the bosim tefach leichazi. Here, what we're talking about is things where if this thing is less than a tefach, then it's no good. A shulya less than a tefach is not a shulya. A shofar less than a tefach is not a valid shofar, etc. And the same thing with all the other things. Over here, aval hocha, but when it comes to the oven, it's the other way around. A tefach is not the minimum amount. It's the maximum amount. Tol shekin debotim tefach yad tamehu. If it's less than a tefach, all the more so that's a yad. The point is that tefach is the maximum. You don't want the yad of the tanner to be too long, because you want to be able to put the tanner as close as possible to the wall. And a long yad gets in the way of that. But if you had a shorter yad, if you had a shorter handle for the oven, it would be all the better. Then you'd be able to put it closer to the wall. So therefore, if there are tefach...
What's the idea of putting it closer to the wall?
Well, you want it as close as possible to the wall, so it's out of the way. So you have more floor space, okay. Right? Because otherwise you're wasting floor space.
Right.
So the yad is like a handle that's sticking out of the oven. You would use it, for example, to move the oven if you needed to. You'd pick up the oven by these handles and move. So therefore, so if you have, if the handles are longer than a tefach, you don't want them, because then it interferes. Longer horizontally from the oven. You don't want them too long, because then it interferes. It's putting it near the wall.
Right.
So therefore, you're going to want to cut them off. Therefore, it's not considered a yad. So the cases with the shulya and the shofar and so forth is it can't be less than a tefach, but it could be longer than that. A shulya can be a minimum of a tefach in length, but it could be many tefach in length. A shofar, same thing. An ezov, same thing. But a yad is the other way around. A tefach is the maximum, not the minimum.
The more it is, the less optional.
Exactly. So therefore, that's why. So that therefore, it doesn't belong in this list. What about, the bottom of tefach, yad tanahu? Certainly, if it's less than a tefach, all the more so, it functions as an effective yad for the tanahu.
The maximum it can have
is a tefach, as opposed to all the other ones is a minimum. Yeah. Right. Okay. What about, the Gemara says, va'ika tanure bonus tefach? How about, though, we have another din. We learned about this in Cholin as well, that the ovens that are used by little girls for play, the size of them is a tefach. meaning that you have old adults use full-size ovens to bake. So girls in those days would have little toy ovens that they would use also to bake. They would actually bake in them. They'd put it in, make a little fire in it, then make a little fire in it and bake little tiny cookies for themselves and their friends or whatever. Yeah. The Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, especially Mishnah and Kalim, Tanur Trilose Abba. Now, like this, the Torah tells us an oven can become Tomei. The Torah also tells us that if an oven becomes Tomei, the only way to make it Tomei is to break it. Tanur Bekiraim Yutah, says the expression in the Gospel. So the Mishnah says there, Tanur Trilose Abba, an oven to begin with has to be at least 4 tefachim tall, meaning if you make an oven less than 4 tefachim tall, it's not considered an oven, it's not a kabel truma, because it's not functional. You can't use an oven that's that short. Ushyarav dalid, and if you break, if a big oven becomes tame, and you broke it, if there's a piece left that's at least 4 tefachim tall, it's still tame, divir of meir. When is that talking about when it was to begin with a large oven? But if it's a small oven, and Tosis explains over here, large and small means as far as width. A wider oven needs to be taller in order to retain the heat. A smaller oven can be shorter. Smaller in horizontal area, that is, in width. So it can be shorter in height. So therefore, so the Chacham say, if it's a small oven, to begin with, it'll be makabel tumah no matter how small it is, once the job of making it is finished, because the usual keli is only makabel tumah when nigmur malachta, and the Gemara is going to explain in a few lines that kol shehu over here means one tefach, ushyara v'rubay, and the Chachamim also say that if an oven is broken when it became tamei, then when are the pieces makabel tumah, as long as you have the piece that's left, it's still the majority of the height of the oven. So Rashi brings from the Gemara that we learned in Chulin that this is not referring to the case where the oven was a tefach tall to begin with, because a piece of an oven that's less than a tefach tall is not functional even for a kid's toy oven. What it means is, Rashi brings from the Gemara over there, is that we mean is when you had a full-size oven, if let's say you had an oven that was 7 tefachim tall, and now you broke it because it became tummy. If you have a piece, let's say you do, and you break it, now you have a piece which is 4 tefachim tall. So it is in and of itself, it's functional as an oven, so you could use an oven 4 tefachim tall, and it's the majority of the original piece, because it was 7, it's 4 out of 7, then it's still makabel tumah. Anyway, the kamakol shehu, and the bride that concerns
so,
of it.
So, you say that the oven was 7 feet tall?
Let's say the oven was 7 fucking tall. Let's say it became tomei, and you broke it, but you still have 4 fucking of height, then it's still tomei, because you still have 4 fucking, and it's still the majority of the height. Anyway, the Kama Kol Shehu, and when the Chachamim said that a small oven Chilase Kol Shehu, what is Kol Shehu for this purpose? Kol Shehu sometimes means even a tiny amount, but here it can't mean that. If you have an oven that's a fraction of an inch tall, it's not functional. Omer Rav Yana Tefach. So Rav Yana says Kol Shehu for our purposes means one Tefach, and the reason is Shekain Oisin Tanure Bonai Tefach, because when girls make themselves, when girls have toy ovens, then they have an oven that's a Tefach tall. A Tefach tall. Again, in width, in width it's fairly small, but in height it's a tefach, and they can put one coal in there, let's say, and again, they can bake little cookies or whatever for themselves. But anyway, so the point is, there you have a din that involves a tefach. The answer is the Gemara says the plug to the kamayim. Okay, but the list of 5 things that we mentioned before is not meant to include things where there was a machlokes. Here, Rav Meir doesn't hold this whole concept of a tefach. Rav Meir doesn't hold this whole tanure bonus business. He says you only look at regular ovens, which have to be at least 4 tefachim tall. So therefore, according to him, there's no such thing as a tefach when it comes to the height of an oven. Okay. So the Gemara points out, Hashka, the Osis Lahachi, actually, once you have that answer, then you can answer in the case of the stone that was attached to the oven that we talked about on Amud Aleph, you could give a different answer, not that it's a matter of a minimum versus a maximum, but Honami Plugdi. You could answer that actually, over there also, we're saying we're not including things that are subject to Machlokes. Jichatani Sefer, because the Sefer of that Braisa says, Amr of Yehuda, or Mishnah, whatever, Amr of Yehuda, or Amr Tefach, Elam and Atanu, or Lakoiso. That, what Yehuda says, when do we say that the maximum length, that the maximum
horizontal dimension of the stone is a tefach, and more than that, it's not a yad, is only if it's between the oven and the wall, because then again, it prevents you from putting the oven near the wall. But if, let's say, you have the oven out in the middle of the room or out in the middle of the yard or whatever, then Rabbi Yehuda would hold there's no particular maximum. So therefore, so again, we're not mentioning things that involve a machlokes. We're only mentioning things that everybody agrees with. That everybody agrees with, right? What about ha'ikum mitzgeres teifach? What about, here's another thing that has to be a tefach, where the Torah tells us that the shulchan that had the lechem aponim on it had to have a frame around it of one tefach. We learned in Menachos Machlokes, was this frame under the tabletop? Was it like it held the legs together, basically? Or was it above the tabletop, like a rim that you have around fancy tables? Whatever it is, the Torah says you have to have a mitzgeres teifach. So there you have something that's a tefach. The answer is b'dichtivam le'kamayri. Okay, but we're not listing things that explicitly says in the Torah. There, the word tefach, but there it says explicitly in the Torah. We didn't have to list it in a list of things that have to be a tefach. Okay. What about another one? We have another thing. We learn in Erevin. You have a din over there about a mavri, an alleyway where. You have an alleyway over there where it's a dead end street. So in order to carry it in on Shabbat, one of the things you have to have is either a lechi or a koda. A koda is a horizontal beam that runs across the width of the front of the mavri. And we say over there that daya lekoda shirachava tefach. It's enough if the koda is at least one tefach wide. That's considered a valid koda. So there you have something else needs to be a tefach. The answer is b'drabbanon le'kamayri. Okay, but our list of five things is not including things that are purely drabbanon. Because the whole concept of having to have a koda is only drabbanon. The daraita, a place that has three walls around that would be mutter to carry in.
Let me ask you a question. Thinking about a car, I'm thinking about a mashkit for a dog. So
Let's talk about that later. Things that are not relevant to the Gemara right now. Let's just deal with that afterwards. Okay. So anyway, so the list of five things that we said on Amud Aleph is referring to things that are dinim d'araisa, but where the Torah does not specify a shiur. So where it's d'araisa and the Torah itself says a tefach, such as the shulchan, then it's not included. And also, if the whole din is d'rabbanan, for example, the case of a koda, then it's also not listed. All the five that we mentioned, shulya, shofar, shedra, etc., are all dinim, are all mitzvahs that are d'araisa. Tumas Nes is Darais, the Shofar is Darais, the Lulav is Darais, etc. But the Shear is not given explicitly in the Torah. The Chachamim had a ton of that. Not the Shearim are Darabam. The Shearim themselves, at least with most, if not all of these things, are Darais. Actually, the Shofar, to Macholokas Rishonim, where it's Darais. The Chachamim told them to us. The Chachamim informed us.
How do they know?
From Torah Shabbat. So in the case of the Shofar, you actually have a Machlokas Rishonim, whether it's Darais or Darabanan. But in the other ones, for example, the Shuya, the Chachamim figured out, or Hashem to begin with told Moshe as part of Torah Shabbat, that the definition of a Shuya is it has to be at least a Tefach. And the same thing with the Lulav, and the same thing with all the other ones, but it doesn't explicitly say in the Sukkim. So that's what the list consists of. Dinim, things where the mitzvah, the din itself is Daraisa, but the actual amount that it's a Tefach, we wouldn't know from Torah Shabbat, we know only from Torah Shabbat. Okay. Fine. Getting back now to the matter of Shulya. Yosef Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta Kamed Rav Kahana. Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta was sitting as a Talmud in front of Rav Kahana. The Yosef Akama, he was sitting and saying the following din. Amr of Yehuda Amr Rav, Kol Shlosha Yomim Harishonim, any time during the first 3 days after the birth, Tolanus Ashulia Bevlad. Then suppose you have a baby was born, and then within three days after that, the Shulia came out, then we can assume that the Shulia belonged to this baby. And therefore, so there's no further trauma as a result of it. After 3 days, we have to be concerned that there might have been a second baby, in the Shulia, because it's not normal for it to wait 3 days after the
baby.
Within 3 days, we can assume. Sometimes it happens. The baby comes out. The baby rips through the Shulia, through the amniotic sac, and comes out. Sometimes it happens. It takes a couple of days for it to be expelled.
Actually, the Gemara is going to talk about later. The Gemara is going to talk about other figures later on. Right now, we have Rabbi Yehuda telling us in the name of Rav that the maximum is 3 days. Mikan ve'elach choshen levlad acher. After that, we have to be concerned there might have been another baby in the shulya, and therefore the shulya is going to be metame the house, as we said in the Mishnah, and therefore you'd also have to be concerned that she might have different yimei truma and yimei tachta. Okay. So we said it's not so much that the shulya itself is metame, but ain't shulya below vlad, so it means there has to have been a baby. So this is Rabbi Yehuda has said in the name of Rav. And Rabbi Yitzchok Shmuel Bar Maaser is reporting that to Rav Kahana. Omerle, so Rav Kahana said, Omi Omer Rav Hachi, did Rav really say that? V'ha Omer Rav, Ein Avlad Mitzakev Achach Veirei Klum. Rav said that when you have two babies in the womb, one of them does not delay coming out after the other one by any significant amount of time. So what are you telling me? That they could conceivably be 3 days apart. Now, actually, the Gemara is going to talk about later on Chof Zayin Amud Aleph, the Gemara is going to talk about a case where twins were born a couple of months apart. Mm-hmm. However, so how does that fit with what we're saying over here? So there's a couple of answers. One of them is that Ramban brings a possibility, although he rejects it, that maybe Rav didn't know actually what happened in that situation. But there's a few different answers. But anyway, Tosfos says it could happen, but it's so rare that Rav doesn't consider it to be a realistic possibility. So that's Rav Kahana asked that. Ishtik. So Rav Yitzchok Shmuel Bar Maaser didn't say anything. In answer to that. He didn't answer. Omale, Dilma Kan Benefo Kan Ben Kayoma. So then Rav Yitzchok Shmuel Bar Maaser says, maybe what it is there's a difference whether the baby that was born first was a stillborn baby or a regular normal baby. Maybe we would say that if the first one, was a nasal, then we're going to say that the other one, then we're going to say the shulya and the other baby with it won't have come out after very long, not even less than 3 days. We can't expect it would take that long. As opposed to if the first one is a ben kayama, then it could take up to 3 days.
So with a nasal, it would say less than
3 days. And yeah, omale, so Rav Kahana answers. Are you saying what Rav himself actually said? In other words, are you just coming up with this on your own? You should know. But Fedosh Omer Rav Hachi, Rav actually explicitly said this. If she miscarried a stillbirth and then a shulya, then kol shloisha yamim tolu nas shulya bevlad. Then during the first 3 days, we can assume that the shulya belonged to this dead baby. Mikan ve'elach choshen levlad acher. But if it's any more than 3 days, we do have to be concerned about a vlad acher. Yolda, but if she gave birth to a live baby, va'achata to kill a shulya, and then afterwards she miscarried the shulya, afila mikan ve'ad asara yamim. Then even if 10 days later, ain choshen levlad acher. Then we don't have to worry about another baby because two babies don't. Because two babies, if one of them is a live baby, doesn't delay that long after the first one. Within 3 days, whether the first baby was a nasal or not, either way, the shulya can be assumed to belong to it. But if it's after 3 days, only if the first baby was alive.
That's what he's saying.
So why was he quiet at first? So Tosfos quotes Rashi. Tosfos understands Rashi that to begin with, he didn't bother answering him because he knew that Rav had made that distinction. Once Rav Yitzchok Shmuel Bar Maaser came up with it on his own, then Rav Kahana told him that that's actually what it is. Tosfos actually learns differently. Tosfos learns that Af Amit Shmai Tzid Rav is not a rhetorical question. It's a statement. You should know. Very good. You came up with on your own what Rav himself said. I'll tell you what Rav himself said in this connection. So to begin with, Ishtik, he didn't say anything. He had forgotten that Rav had said that. Then once Rav Yitzchok Shmuel Bar Maaser said that, then that jogged Rav Kahana's memory, and then he remembered that actually you hit exactly on what Rav himself said. Okay. Fine. More on this connection, the Gemara says, Shmuel the Talmidim the Rav Rav Yehuda Havu Yasvi. One time Shmuel and the Talmidim of Rav and Rav Yehuda were all sitting together. Now Rav passed away a few years before Shmuel. Rav Yehuda had been a Talmud of Rav, and after Rav passed away, Rav Yehuda became Shmuel's Talmud, and he used to tell Shmuel various things that Rav had said. Yeah. So in this case, they had Shmuel and Rav Talmidim and Rav Yehuda are all sitting together. Of course it's possible. Yes, why not? Your Rebbe has passed away. What are you supposed to do? Stay without a Rebbe? Yeah. So what? So cholif v'ozor Rav Yosef Breder of Menachem. So the these three groups were sitting together: Shmuel the Amora, the Talmidim of Rav, the Talmidim of Shmuel's colleague Rav, and Rav Yehuda, who had formerly been a Talmud of Rav and now is a Talmud of Shmuel. Cholif v'ozor Rav Yosef Breder of Menachem at Dvil Latayu. Then along came Rav Yosef, the son of Rav Menachem from Dvil, came towards them. Boli va'osi, and he was hurrying, he was running and coming. Omar, so Shmuel says, in a little bit of a disparaging tone about him, Osi lon gabra, here comes a man, this Rabbi Yosef. Bepashtus Omar, which is what we say over here, Bepashtus means that Shmuel said this. I've seen a different girsa, Omru, that maybe it means that Rav Talmidim said this. Anyway, they said about Rabbi Yosef, Osi lon gavra, here comes a man, d'raminin le begila d'chista, that we're able to ask on him kashus and kashus and contradictions on what he says, even with weak school, like with insubstantial questions, and yet we're able to ask such questions on him and reject what he says because he doesn't know the answer even to such things. So one point is I saw an explanation about this. You actually have a Gemara in Kedushin that tells how one time the same Rav Yosef, Rav Menashe, paskin in a certain halacha in a certain case involving Sufik Kedushin in a way that Shmuel strongly disapproved of. So therefore, so that might fit with our Gemara over here, that therefore Shmuel, especially if we have the Girsa over here, Omar, that Shmuel is saying, you should know, this guy is not somebody who's reliable, la la. Okay. Ada hochi osa, as they were talking, meanwhile Rabbi Yosef actually came towards them, Omar le Shmuel, so Shmuel asked him, my Omar Rav b'shulya, you were a Talmud of Rav, so tell me, what did Rav say as a shulya? Because he's saying that if he says an independent statement, then we're easily able to refute it. But we can still rely on him to tell us what Rav said. He was still a Talmud of Rav, because he's still a Talmud of Rav.
Then
we can accept it. But he himself, you should know, is not him. Okay. So he asked him, my Omer Rav b'shulya. What did Rav say as far as a shulya? So you have, again, a baby was born. Well, yeah, when do we say that the shulya relates to the baby, and when do we say no? Amale, so Rabbi Yosef tells him, Hachi Omer Rav, Ein Tolan, it's a shulya ele b'dabba shokayam. You can only attribute the shulya to something that is able to live. Meaning, in other words, so what does it mean, Dabar Shokayama? Rashi explains it's not a difference whether the baby is alive or whether the live baby with it is alive or dead. It's a difference even if the baby itself is stillborn, but is it fully formed so that it could have been alive? Or does it have the form where it could have been alive, and it just happens that this particular one died in the womb? Then we would say the shulya belongs there. As opposed to, Rashi says, let's say the various kinds of deformations that we talked about earlier in the parak. Let's say, for example, we said if it was born with one eye or one leg in the middle instead of one side, or goof otum or whatever, so then we said, then we can't attribute the shulya to it, then we have to be concerned even within 3 days that the shulya may have come from another baby, because a deformed, a baby that's so severely deformed wouldn't have a shulya like that. That's how Rashi learns. Tosfos has a long discussion about it over here, and other Rishonim also, and they say that other Rishonim say that Dabar Shokayama means only if the baby is actually alive. The Rambam, for example, learns that way. The Rambam learns that if the woman has a stillborn baby, and afterwards a shulya comes out, you have to be concerned. The shulya belongs to another baby. He learns that only if there was a live birth can you assume that a shulya that comes out afterwards belongs to that baby. And Achronim give a reason for that. This is a live baby, tears through the shulya, tears through the amniotic sac and comes out. So therefore, it's likely that it hangs around in the womb there for a little bit afterwards and then comes out. As opposed to, if it's stillbirth, it's not tearing through, so why is it not coming out together with it? So then we have to assume maybe it's another baby. Okay. Anyway, so that's what Rabbi Yosef tells him, that in Cholonas shulya, ela b'dabba shokayama. Shairinu Shmuel l'chol talmidim of Rav. So Shmuel started asking all the other talmidim of Rav to verify. V'amilei hochi. And they said, yeah, indeed, that's what Rav said. Hoder Chazir, a little bit Hoder Bishus. So now,
he said he wasn't reliable.
Now, fine, but, well, okay, so now maybe that's why you have to check with the other Talmudim. So now he looks angrily at Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, you're a Talmud of Rav. How is it that you never told me what Rav says on this? And other Mephoshim explain. Also, not only that, not only he didn't tell him, but actually we had the Shmuel is looking at Rabbi Yehuda angrily, with meaning, in other words, his expression meant, why didn't you tell me this? Disapprovingly, why didn't you tell me this all this time? Other Mephoshim also point out that it's not just that he didn't tell him, but we actually had at the beginning of the Sugya, earlier on the Omud, we said that Rabbi Yehuda had said in the name of Rav differently, that it depends whether it's within the 3 days or not. So then Shmuel is looking very disapprovingly at Rabbi Yehuda. You're telling me one thing that Rav said, and here all of Rav's Talmidim are telling you that he said something else. So therefore he's looking at him disapprovingly, you told me the wrong thing. Okay. So therefore he was upset with Rabbi Yehuda anyway. Okay. Fine.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.